Next week, the Hawaii Community Foundation will officially have a new leader. Mike Akane will become its CEO, succeeding Kelvin Takeda. During his tenure, Kelvin Takeda has overseen the growth of HCF as Hawaii's largest charitable foundation. HCF has more than doubled its assets under administration, with over 750 large and small individual, family, and business funds. The nonprofit Times recognized him as one of the 50 most powerful and influential people in the sector and featured him in the GiveSmart.org website on philanthropy. Now, after a 19-year stewardship, Kelvin Takeda will turn over the CEO office on July 1st, but he'll be sticking around for at least a year as a senior fellow. Since last month, he and Mike Akane have been working together on the transition, perhaps made easier, as Mike Akane has been the organization's president and chief operating officer since January 2016 and was a board member for 8 years prior. Today on Town Square, we'll talk with both men about the Hawaii nonprofit community, its past and especially its future, and the future of HCF. And we want to hear from you if you're involved with nonprofits in any way. Our number, 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, please use that one. And from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream, call us at 877-941-3689. Welcome to you both. Good to see you.
Aloha, Bethann.
Thanks, Bethann.
We've had a lot of conversations over the years, Kelvin Takeda, and in looking at that journey over these last 19 years, I'm really curious about how, when you came into the Hawaii Community Foundation, what you saw within the nonprofit community then, and I want to talk to you a little bit about how it's changed, but what was it that you were faced with 19 years ago?
Well, if you remember in the late 90s, this was before the dot-com bubble burst, and I think there was a great deal of optimism, not just in Hawaii, but in our country, about the economy and technology and all the great things that it was going to bring. And I think there was a sense of optimism among the nonprofit community here. Certainly, I came into this job after 18 years of being at the Nature Conservancy and wanting to really spend the next chapter of my life giving back to my home. But I had a lot to learn, and I would say that one of the things that struck me immediately was the incredible both tension and partnership that existed between the government and the nonprofit sector, where the government still remains and, in fact, has grown to be an increasingly larger revenue supporter for the nonprofit sector, in part because the nonprofit sector is carrying out all these goods and services that used to be provided by the government. And that trend was already underway before I got to the Community Foundation, but has continued to grow over that time.
I remember early in your tenure, you also made the comment to the community at large that you really felt that there was more collaboration that was necessary because funds were going to be getting more strictly given and that the money was going to be, you know, drying up in certain pools that people had traditionally looked toward as, you know, their funding mechanism.
Yeah, and I think that continues to be a theme. You know, I think that we saw in the recession when giving went down that it was even more important for people to pull in and figure out a way to partner and to work more efficiently. I think that continues today. The good news is you see more and more of it happening. I attribute that in part to the leadership of the Community Foundation and our team that really went out there and played a role in convening and facilitating among nonprofits so that they could see themselves as collaborators and partners and less as competitors in that environment. And I think it has proven to be a really effective strategy.
Mike Akane, you were certainly in the community at that point in time and watching how some of this was developing. What do you think made the difference in nonprofits realizing that they needed to collaborate or that there was greater virtue in working together than keeping each individual fiefdom?
Well, I think definitely accepting the dialogue that, you know, there's going to be a limitation on resources and a need for people to really look at the goal and outcome of what we're trying to achieve as a community versus what our individual goals were. And I think Kelvin's point around, HCF's engagement into that sector and serving as a convener around participants and nonprofits that kind of positioned themselves as competitors within a space became partners within a space. And there's multiple examples of how HCF over the past 15 years has played a more critical role in convening and creating kind of a collaborative environment. And I think we need to continue doing that.
How do you see that critical role as having changed?
Well, there needs to be more of it. I mean, most recently in the homeless issue, a recent story that you had a few weeks ago, Scott talked about how organizations need to work together. Under our Housing ASAP program, under the leadership of Chris Van Burgett, we brought together 8 of the more active nonprofits working in that space that represents more than 60% of the beds throughout the state of Hawaii. Those were groups that were competing with one another in one of the most crisis issues that we're facing as a state. More of that needs to happen across multiple sectors in that area.
Homelessness has taken on a greater part of our attention in the last couple of years, but I can remember having conversations with you about homelessness 18 years ago,
yep,
when people were sort of putting up the hand like this, like, no, don't really want to talk about that. That's not really someplace we want to go. That must have been frustrating for you because clearly you saw it.
Yeah, in reflection of my tenure at the Community Foundation, the inspiration and enthusiasm I have for having seen how the generosity in this community can really effectuate change or materially impact for the better people's lives has been leavened in part by the fact that some of the most intractable problems still remain. And homelessness was one. In fact, Micah was involved in that when he was the chair of the Department of Homelands when Linda Lingle was the governor. And, you know, the homeless situation was a very, very dear issue for that governor. And so, you know, it still remains. But what I'll tell you is what Micah pointed out with Housing ASAP is as we began to bring these groups together and they began to work and collaborate and really push towards changing the practice and the systems, we are now seeing evidence of a change where we focused on homeless families. For the point in time count this year showed that there was a 19% decrease in the number of families that were homeless in the state. And I think that's the result of a heroic effort from those nonprofits that have really worked very hard to change their practices and become much more adept at moving people through emergency shelters and into permanent housing.
If you're just joining us now for Town Square, we're taking a look at the nonprofit community throughout Hawaii with Kelvin Takeda, who is soon to be the ex-CEO of the Hawaii Community Foundation. He will remain as a senior fellow for at least a year, so he's not going away. Micah Kane is with us, too. He's the incoming CEO and obviously the former president and chief operating officer and longtime board member. We want to hear from you, too, as you're looking out at Hawaii's nonprofit community. What do you see? How are you involved with it, if you are? And what do you think the role of Hawaii's nonprofit community should be? That's a question I want to take up with the two of you now. We've seen that change over time, not just during your tenure, Kelvin, but also, you know, before that, really people looking to nonprofits to, as you mentioned a moment ago, pick up the slack from what wasn't happening with government, but also looking to the nonprofit community to lead in a way that it really hadn't before, to be that convener and to be able to move certain agendas forward, including homelessness. So, I mean, how do you see that movement of change within the nonprofit community? And, Mike, I want to ask you the same thing, too.
Well, I think the bad news first. The bad news is that any significant cuts in government funding at the federal or state level would not be possible to replace those funds with philanthropic dollars. The nonprofit sector here is about a $5 to $6 billion revenue industry. The majority of those funds come from government contracts and grants. And if there was a 10% cut, let's say $500 million, there wouldn't be a corresponding way for foundations and individuals to plug that gap. So pay attention, because as we see the federal budget unfold and what will happen in Hawaii as our economy starts to slow down or appears to be slowing down, then we're going to have to look at, you know, how we try to work differently or what how we prioritize things based on that. The good news is, as you look across the landscape in Hawaii, I see phenomenal leadership and potential leadership coming out of the nonprofit sector in a way that, frankly, I don't see in some of the other sectors. And so, you know, this is if ever there is a moment for our nonprofit community to step forward and lead and paint a vision for what Hawaii should be like and what the social contract for all of our citizens should be, I think it's the nonprofit sector's opportunity to really grab onto that and to really and to voice that.
And, Micah, how do you see them doing that? What do you see in the way of changes within the community and what its proper role is?
Well, I think Kelvin's point about trying to anticipate and get ready for some of the policy changes that are going to be happening at the federal level and helping the nonprofit community better respond and react more quickly is a role that we're going to need to play and that nonprofits are going to need to be more agile in. Kelvin spoke a little bit earlier about this movement over the past 10 to 15 years on government's dependency on nonprofits to execute on their behalf in many ways. And so they gear up, they staff up, they build up, and as that attrition occurs through policy, we haven't, you know, geared up in a way to retract back. And so we experienced a little of this about 2 years ago under our Housing ASC program when federal government shifted to a Housing First a program where they moved away from the transitional shelter concept into a permanent housing concept.
Driven by HUD. Mm-hmm.
Driven by HUD. Yeah. Policy change at a federal level where funding is going to force nonprofits to act differently. And that adjustment needed to occur, and that was a role HCF played in helping our nonprofits to make that adjustment. More of that's going to happen as we move to a block grant system. And so we're having conversations now within the sector of how can we better facilitate those opportunities so when it does happen, nonprofits are at the table working with policymakers to assure that services continue in the most critical areas.
You know, Micah raised a really interesting point, Bethann, because Housing ASAP was a really interesting case study in where philanthropic dollars can make the biggest difference, right? Because HUD drove the change and told the transitional emergency shelter providers, we're not going to continue to support those programs. You now have to help people get into permanent housing. And there's lots of data to suggest why that was the right move. What they didn't give them was money to change the way they worked and their systems and the skill sets and everything else. That's what our money went into. The 12 funders that all got together and hooed together to help them. And it was like the WD-40, if you think about it that way, that really helped them move faster towards that change. I think that's where philanthropy, we're not going to be able to make up the difference in programmatic funding if programmatic funding is cut by government. We are going to have to just find a way of providing philanthropic support to help organizations think smarter and do things differently.
But some of that is going to be reflected directly in policy. Yesterday, I talked to Jessica Yamauchi from the Hawaii Public Health Institute, and her point is, as we're all focusing on Medicaid dollars being slashed from health care bills, whichever one you want to look at, and whatever, you know, may happen, the big concern is what will happen with, for her at least, was the, with the public health and prevention fund, because of those dollars that will simply go away, $17 million that
That's
will
right.
go away. And her idea is, look, you know, the nonprofit community cannot absorb something of that magnitude.
That's right. And so one of the things that we're trying to do now is we're going to be sponsoring a conference for nonprofit organizations, if I do a plug for our website to go and check it out, in August, particularly to help nonprofits become better advocates about the issues and causes that they're trying to serve, not just to go to the legislature or to Congress and ask for more money, but to really put forward the policy framework that is compelling for legislators or Congress to consider funding, right? And so The nonprofits are in the trenches. They are doing the work every day, and their voice needs to be activated and amplified in a way that they haven't been able to do so far. And I think there's a moment in time for them to do that.
So what is the mechanism to amplify that voice?
Well, clearly better communication up and down 360 degrees throughout the sector and those who are involved. Kelvin spoke about the nonprofit community coming together. What's critical about this scenario that he articulated is the policymakers. And what's been nice is that there's a recognition by key policymakers in our state to collaborate and step up to the table. Early conversations with House Speaker Scott Sikey and Senate President Ron Cochi are very open to wanting to collaborate and go into session with a platform of understanding of how we might be more efficient. And I think it starts there. I think that communication early and often is going to be very important to our success.
If you're joining us now for Town Square, we're talking about the future of the Hawaii Community Foundation under its new leader, who you just heard, Mike Akane. Its outgoing leader, CEO Kelvin Takeda, at least for one more day, Kelvin.
He's here. I still have my parking spot.
You have your parking spot, and you'll have an office down the hall from Mike's, because you're not going to go anywhere, at least for a year or so as a senior fellow. But what do you see as you look into Hawaii's nonprofit community? Are you engaged with it? Do you find that it engages you? 941-3689 is our number to engage with us if you're calling from Oahu and from the neighbor islands. It's 877-941-3689. So many of us depend on the work of nonprofits. What do you see as being that changing role, is what you've been listening to, or have you been listening to what both Mike Akane and Kelvin Takeda have been talking about their visions? But what's yours for Hawaii's nonprofit community? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We've talked a little bit about the community itself, the community of nonprofits. But what about donors? We've watched donors really change in the last, I'd say, 5 years, especially noticing those changes, and what donors want from their organizations, and when they choose to make a donation, if they choose to have a smaller family foundation. What do donors want now from what you see when you talk to them, Micah?
Well, Kelvin, 3 years ago, you know, started a vision to celebrate 100 years of service on behalf of the Hawaii Community Foundation, to celebrate our centennial. And the primary push of that is really to grow the pool of people engaging in philanthropy, and for people to realize that, you know, you don't need to be, you know, in the mass affluent to engage. There's many ways to engage. Today, and Kelvin is an expert in this space, is there's a movement on behalf of people to see their contributions have an impact today. And to not only leave something beyond their lives so that it can have an impact beyond their lives, but to see improvements happen today and to see their money and their donations and their resources get put to work. And that's where our focus is shifting towards. And that's why we're moving into more initiative work, where it's driving us into having more conversations with policymakers, trying to be a bridge and a convener of stakeholders who might not think the same way, but have a endpoint that is common.
Or might not even see themselves as stakeholders.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think, you know, we talked about this before, Beth Ann, but, you know, think of yourself as going to shop for a refrigerator. And, you know, 20 years ago when I started in this business, everybody would just go to Sears and find the friendliest looking sales guy and ask him what refrigerator you should buy. And now everybody goes armed with consumer reports and all these other things. And, you know, we're now educated consumers. So same thing is happening in donations. Technology and the Internet have made it possible for people to investigate a great deal so that they're much more aware of organizations and what they say they're doing. It has made them better consumers and donors as a consequence. It has raised expectations of those donors as to what nonprofits do or say they do. All those things are for the better. And now I think you're starting to see a movement where people are trying to find a way to have a bigger impact than just working by themselves. Crowdfunding, you know, hooies of people getting together. We're seeing it now more and more at the Community Foundation, where around a given area of interest like the environment, you know, we went from a handful of funders interested in the environment to over 30 funders now who sit down on a regular basis, who all care about the environment. They're funding different things, but they want to share ideas and try to work together. That gives you the ability to create synergy and leverage that didn't exist before.
We're going to go to the phones now and take some of your calls. If you want to join the conversation with Kelvin Takeda and Mike Akani, call us on Town Square at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you call us from the neighbor islands. And we have Lloyd calling us from Haiku, Maui. Aloha, Lloyd. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. It's a really great discussion. Certainly, no one living in Hawaii has not benefited from the hard work that the nonprofits do. They do what some people think government should do, but government really can't because it doesn't have the heart in the communities as nonprofits do. I'd just like to make a comment about the idea of efficiency. That's kind of a problem that's coming up around the country where people are thinking that being efficient means success, or being efficient means we've accomplished our mission, when in fact sometimes being efficient cuts out a lot of the culture that needs to be taken into consideration for all nonprofits, and that is what makes them live and breathe. Maybe the guests can discuss the idea of that relative to the work that their organization is doing going forward.
All right, Kelvin, you want to take that one on?
Yeah.
And thanks, Lloyd, for the call.
I think Lloyd's right. Efficiency is a part of the equation, but it isn't the whole thing. Effectiveness is certainly the other side of that coin. And I think that one of the things we're trying to work with government agencies now to do is to find a better way of, for them to evaluate success or what success might look like in the way they contract, for example, with organizations that are doing human service work so that they don't just give the contract to the lowest bidder, but the one that's going to actually accomplish the most. It's a difficult thing to try to find the right way to determine and articulate success in the nonprofit sector. You take a great organization like Boys and Girls Club, who obviously, you know, is changing lives, but in the end, what people are hoping is that some of the kids they're working with are going to graduate from college. Well, they're not going to see that happen, right? Because they get those kids in middle school. So, you know, how do you articulate your success in that circumstance? Or they're not going to see it happen because that's going to happen 6 or 7 or 8 years from now. So it's a challenging thing for nonprofits. What we have found is that the best nonprofits constantly wrestle with this idea, recognizing that they may not come up with the perfect answer. So to Lloyd's point, it's about the culture. You have to be reflective, and you have to be willing to continue to try to get better and change as you go along to meet changing needs. And we see the best nonprofits, the high-performing nonprofits, all have a absolute manic determination around effectiveness.
Mike, I'm hearing Kelvin talk about quality and being able to have a vision of a future versus just short-term cost, which, as he mentions, is pretty tough for organizations to do, and that's the big struggle. How do you see that struggle moving into the future with life changing so rapidly, including what technology makes possible?
Well, I think two things kind of pop up in my mind as Kelvin was talking. I mean, the first is that people who function in the nonprofit sector are dealing with the same compressions and pressures of society in a way that the average person is dealing with. The cost of housing, the cost of education, just the cost of living, and that compression is seen in our community. And as financial challenges compress upon those, it's exponentially impacted those who are working in that space. As Kelvin was speaking, it made me think about the role maybe HCF can play going forward, and our role to preserve the culture is really to try to smooth out some of those troughs a bit so that we can preserve the culture to give people a breath to hopefully catch the next wave. And And it's hard because, as Calvin mentioned earlier, you know, philanthropy is not going to fill the gap that government is moving away from. And so being very strategic and thoughtful about where we can make our greatest investments, I think, is going to be very important going forward.
You're listening to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. You're just listening to Mike Akane. And we have Kelvin Takeda here, too, both from the Hawaii Community Foundation, one the outgoing CEO, one the incoming CEO, and looking at where we're going in Hawaii's nonprofit community. And we're curious about what you see, what role you find for nonprofits in your own life, or what the expectations are within the greater community. Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. So much is made to be done by nonprofits, may increase in that way as we see future funding cut from the federal government. What do you think nonprofits need to focus on? What would you tell Mike Akane, the incoming CEO of the Hawaii Community Foundation? What would you like to hear from Kelvin Takeda as he's now becoming a senior fellow? 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689. We have a shy caller who phoned from Honolulu, shy meaning not wanting to go on the air, said that to both of you, why can't the nonprofit community and people with power in the community help lobby against and pressure people who are building all of these hotels and transit authority housing initiatives to build affordable housing instead of hotels? They are very powerful, but until the city council stops granting permission to stop building, they're just building for the rich. You know, this idea is one that we've heard over and over again. Are we really paying attention to people who most need it, especially as both of you have identified housing as being, as we all know, one of the greatest issues that so many of us face?
You know, in most recently when we were having conversations with Scott Murashige, who's working for the governor's office as the director of homeless there, the number one issue he pointed as the biggest challenge for him is the growing pipeline of people falling into homelessness versus those coming out. And he identified affordable housing as one of the most critical issues that we need to face as a community. And I think we agree with that. You know, we're starting to pay attention more and look at ways in which Hawaii Community Foundation might be able to convene in that space. It's been an area that is much more complex than we understand right now and are starting to socialize that issue. Clearly, policymakers, I think, would agree that there needs to be a solution. There was quite a bit of conversation during this legislative session around a focus on affordable rentals, something that we agree with and believe is probably where we should pay a priority focus on. And concessions were being made by stakeholders across the industry as well as within government to try to move that forward. A bill was passed, and I think we're going to see the impacts of that bill. I think there needs to be some scalability to that I think can show impacts to the community that hope can build some confidence that this is part of the solution.
You talk about socializing this issue. How do you see that issue being socialized?
Well, it's a much more complex issue than people think. You know, some of the challenges around it that we're involved in is on the issue of water. You know, 4 years ago, the Hawaii Community Foundation saw the water conversation being a crisis between the growth community and the environmental community. And rather having an argument around the limited resources that we're dealing with, let's create a plan to grow the resource. And so, you know, that strategy, which today is a goal to reestablish 100 million gallons of new fresh water, takes that issue off the table when it comes to housing and growth, because that is one of the biggest challenges to housing is, do you have the resources to support it, and water being one of them. We're playing on the periphery of that, but that's a complexity that people wouldn't think about when dealing with this issue.
Anything you wanted to add to that, or should we go on to more calls?
No, let's go on to more calls.
All right, calling now from Javi, we have Gus on the line. Aloha, Gus. Welcome to Town Square.
Good afternoon, folks. I love what you're doing. I love where your hearts are. I know you guys are into justice. Here's one for you. We put a lot of energy into the homeless. We put a lot of energy into the tourist industry. What are we doing for our little local Hawaiian kids, Hawaiian families that are homeless, that have gotten this They got occupied. We are occupiers, gang. 1,000 wrongs don't make a right. This is a chance for us to rectify a huge mistake. The queen thing is real. Please,
okay,
you guys are the tip of the spear. Let's take care of our indigenous.
All right, let me get you an answer. I think they've got your point that maybe, Micah, we're not paying enough attention to indigenous issues. I mean, there's so many issues to pay attention to all at once. But his comment really seems to go to the idea, are we losing sight of some very real and basic issues surrounding indigenous people?
Well, I think the recent Hokulea and the travel around the world, you know, shows that we can pivot towards a positive conversation versus a negative conversation. I think it's much easier to step outside, you know, the footprint of Hawaii to really see the role that Hawaii and the indigenous culture can play, not just in Hawaii, but in the world. And for it to be a culture that has, you know, long-term broad benefit to not just the Native Hawaiian community, but those who call Hawaii their home.
And everybody.
And, you know, it is, I believe, our competitive advantage in the world, and something that if we can get more to embrace, we'll have a lot more success.
All right, we're going to go on now to Tom, calling us from Lava Hoi Hoi. Tom, welcome to Town Square.
Hi, yes. This is a great subject, and I love to talk to my four children about this. My four children are Kamehameha grads. And Micah just said about being competitive. One area for college students is scholarships are highly competitive. And what I've taught my children are, if you go out and you pick a nonprofit to volunteer for, when you apply for those scholarships, they look at those at your community service that you've done. And all four of my children have been so blessed with scholarships just because they took the time and they served a nonprofit, because what goes around really comes around. And I just wanted to make that point with Micah.
All right. Thanks very much, Tom. You know, some schools certainly have a community service commitment that one has to make before you graduate. It's part of your graduation requirement. But that's different than teaching the ethos of being of service in a family. When it used to be that one learned about this at home, you saw parents volunteering. It just became a way of life for a lot of families. Other families, maybe not so much. But how do you see that generational ethic of being of service being transmitted now in terms of how nonprofits welcome younger folks into their fold, perhaps as volunteers?
You know, having been in this almost for 40 years, one of the most nuanced revelations that I came to was how I thought I was entering a world of service, of giving back to the community, and I realized that the person who benefited the most from it was me. And I think that when I talk to donors, it's the same thing. They sort of start with this ethos that they want to give back. They want to pay it forward. And in fact, the people who are most enriched by their act is them. So while I do believe in service, and I think it's important for everybody in the community to do it, I'm a firm believer that the greatest beneficiary of giving is to the giver.
And there's science that backs that up. Obviously, the series that we did with Bob Wehrman,
right,
that was supported by the Hawaii,
right,
Community Foundation in support of its 100th anniversary.
Right.
And there was a whole segment, I remember, that he did about what science says about,
sure,
giving and what it does,
yeah,
to your body.
And I think to the caller's point about his children, and I think it's fantastic that his kids have done it. I would say that while they probably did a great job of helping those nonprofits and it did help them get scholarships, the reason they got the scholarships was that experience working for the nonprofits gave them a contextual sense, a certain kind of maturity about the world that they wouldn't get otherwise. And so, you know, I really believe that that's the magic of volunteering. It's a two-for-one deal, right? You volunteer and you help somebody or you help an organization, but the reality is it enriches your life beyond belief. So, you know, I just I wanted to make that case. It has been the greatest single revelation for me in the career that I've had.
Going to go on now. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone lines are open. 941-3689 if you call us from Oahu, or 877-941-3689 if you call us from the Neighbor Islands, or if you're listening to the live stream, you're welcome to join the conversation too, as we're looking at the nonprofit community in Hawaii and what are the roles that you see for nonprofits as we're moving into a future with some uncertain funding, certainly coming from the federal government, and just in general, as more is being asked of nonprofits in very different ways than was asked from them even in many years past. Malohia, calling us from Honolulu, is on the line. Aloha, welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. Hello. I'm registered for the workshop that ACF is sponsoring in August. And as a Hawaiian and part of the Royal Society's Hawaiian and Civic Club, one, we need help with organization documents for 501c3. And two, we both, I see it, that we're losing our membership because we're having a difficult time talking stories, gathering as groups, and learning more about what it is to be proud as Hawaiians, not only the Hokulea. That's certainly helping. But we need to gather to see who we are as Hawaiians and what made us proud that we won't be homeless, we won't be jobless. But I thought ACF could also help us in this arbitration, mediation as groups, and encourage more participation in our group. I wanted to hear Micah and Kelvin.
All right. Well, they have an answer for you, Malohia. Thank you so much for the call. All right, Kelvin, you want to take that first, or Micah, you want to take it first?
I'll take a shot at it. Okay. You know, I think, my grandfather and my grandmother was the founding fathers of the Nanakuli Hawaiian Civic Club. You know, they believed in the civic engagement of the people, regardless of their ethnicity. And, I look at it in that context where, regardless of what your ethnicity is, it's time for us to civically engage and to not lose hope that our time engaged in the community in various capacities can make a difference. I think if you look throughout the world with what's happened in Brexit, what's happened in the national elections, there's a sentiment that, you know, our engagement cannot have an impact on how our world and how our communities are going to evolve. And there's no better time than now for us to reinvigorate and find a way to cross that bridge towards positive civic engagement. And the Hawaiian community can play a role in that. And but I also think there's even a bigger piece that I think is very important.
Anything that you wanted to add to that?
Well, Kelvin? I'm glad that she's coming to the conference, and I think that she'll find a lot of similar sentiments among the people that come to the conference about the kind of capacity and skills that we need to build in order to do the kinds of things that Mike is talking about. So, you know, we're very interested in this particular conference and focusing on a couple of things. One, the advocacy work, and certainly some of the other things that we're trying to accomplish with nonprofits. But we're open to ideas about how we can continue to build the skills and capacity of the community.
An observation of nonprofits over time in Hawaii is that we have a whole lot of them. And maybe we don't need a whole lot more, but we need maybe better networking and collaboration within those that we have, because that is perhaps a better way of building strength. Do you still feel that way, Kelvin?
Yeah, you know, the number, it's a little bit more than 5,000 that are registered 501c3 public charities. And that number kind of hangs around there. It's hard to say how active all of them are, because unlike businesses, when a nonprofit goes dormant, it just goes dormant, right? So it just sort of still sits there. The IRS is now in a process of cleaning their books up, so to speak. So that number is changing. I don't think there's any question that it's very, very difficult to be a small nonprofit, and it's just challenging. There's so much stuff you have to do. I started with a small nonprofit that became a big nonprofit, and I can tell you that as we grew bigger, it got easier.
Sometimes there are economies of scale.
Yeah, and it's just, and so I have a great deal of affection and loyalty to small nonprofits, but I think it is challenging. So the more that organizations, and not just nonprofits, but community groups, so can join together to find critical mass, I think that's a more effective solution at times than we sometimes think.
Micah, do you want to add anything to that, or
we'll
move on?
I think we can move on.
Okay, good. Going to Claude, calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Claude. Welcome to Town Square. Thank you for your patience.
Hello.
Hello. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Claude. Can you hear me?
We can. Go ahead.
I wanted to thank you very much for this show. Your speakers are very thoughtful, and I thank them for that. My question had to do with the issue of place-based philanthropy and interventions. Most notable of these, and maybe one of the earliest, was the Harlem Children's Zone in New York City, where they took essentially a four-block zone and invested in integrated series of interventions, including education, health, housing, early childhood care, all around a particular neighborhood. And that's proven to be extremely effective and has become an increasingly used approach. And I've always thought that the Hawaiian Ahapua system would give us an opportunity to intervene in a place-based way where individual nonprofits could take on the responsibility for particular ahapuas and the integration of services from across the community. And there would be fantastic ways then of evaluating the actual outcomes in given ahapuas. And
all
I wonder
right,
what
Claude,
your panelists thought.
Let me get an answer for you, too. So what about, he's sort of suggesting that we do this in a place-based way, that we maybe create a stream of nonprofits or, a nonprofit ahupua'a and be able to take over responsibilities for certain areas.
I think, Harlem Children's Zone's in a remarkable story, and Jeff Canada's really done a great job with it. It is now, Jeff is actually out there now trying to replicate Harlem's Children's Zone type approach in other cities. And the challenge always becomes one of the intrinsic capacity of a community to do that kind of work. I think Kamehameha Schools, of which Mike is a trustee, is kind of leading the charge in this area about place-based investment. There's lots of promising opportunity to do it. The Community Foundation is excited about our growing partnership with Kamehameha Schools to do this kind of work. So, it has merits. At the same time, you have to. There are other stools to that leg. You have to build the capacity in the community to be able to take those funds and be effective at what they do. And then the second part is you have to have larger systems that feed into it, because as good as you can be, at some point the children will leave that spot. And they're going to go to community college, or they're going to go to college. And you need to find a way to continue to support them through that whole effort.
Our number is 941-3689. If you call us from Oahu, use that number, please, 941-3689, or 877-941-3689. As we're looking at the nonprofit community within Hawaii, what its role is now, we're talking with two people who know it well, Kelvin Takeda, who is the outgoing CEO of the Hawaii Community Foundation, and Micah Kane, its incoming CEO. And we want to hear from you, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Micah, did you want to add anything to
that? Yeah, I did. I think Claude's point to move towards he used the ahupua'a concept as a example, but contextually larger, moving towards a geographic-based approach towards the quality of life that people experience in their communities does a couple things. One, it forces you to put parameters around how we're performing against each other. And the second, it gives a community an understanding of their performance. And I think that's very important. I use an example of the average daily commute that a person in a community experiences on a daily basis. Anecdotally, I believe that once somebody's lifestyle in commuting to work goes over an hour, their decision-making changes. First thing they think about is, how do I make it easier for my children? And so I decide to move my child into another community to go to school. The moment I do that, my engagement to be a part of the PTA group in my community moves to the community that my child is going to school in. And then it's, well, I want my child to have after-school activities. Instead, it removes that decision to make that activity in my community to the community that my child is going to school in. At that point, they're leaving at 6 a.m. and they're returning at 6 p.m. without any sense of who their neighbor is. And so just that issue, for example, of average daily commute may not be an issue that I would think about unless I started looking at a place-based concept. And I think that is where some of the art comes in about where policy changes and discussions can start to take place. Doesn't happen unless you start moving to that conversation.
I'm glad you brought up art because we have Susie Bond on the line calling us from the Big Island. Aloha, Susie. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, thank you. I've been running errands, and so I haven't listened to absolutely everything. But one of the big issues, I run a very, very small community theater company on the edge of the volcano here on the Big Island. And grant money is non-existent to groups like us and to the arts. And I know that, like, the homeless is a very important issue, and their needs are great. But, you know, without the arts, you know, it's important because we bring, like, this summer we have entire families involved in it, and we're bringing children up and teaching them the values that you get when you get to theater. But, you know, for us as a nonprofit, we just have to beg for money from our local community because the big grant picture seems to have dried up in the arts.
Okay, Susie, I'm going to just stop you there in the interest of time. But it seems in some ways that she is an example of what you just talked about, Micah, and looking at your community and having to go to it and being part of it, because in her case, there are not a lot of dollars that are flowing into her very small nonprofit.
I think she's right, and it's a problem. I mean, we're seeing less and less resources going to the arts, which is a critical piece of a child's growth and a community's identity.
I mean, it's hard to say what's the, you know, priority one when everything else is a priority one.
Absolutely. Kelvin, what's your thoughts?
Yeah,
on
no, I mean, I think that we're concerned about supporting arts and cultural organizations in our community and continue to try to do the best we can. But you know, there are personal preferences that donors and businesses have, and, you know, you just got to try to make the best case you can.
Are they shifting? I mean, because once upon a time, arts was sort of a place that certain groups of people would gravitate toward.
I don't think so. I mean, when we look at the nonprofit industry studies, we've seen a growth, for example, in environmental funding, but and certainly there are demographic changes in what people are interested in.
But, certainly religious organizations,
right,
not getting as much as they once got.
Right, and the millennials certainly care about the arts and the environment more than they care about certain other things. So, you know, we're going to see these ebbs and flows. But, you just hope that Susie can hang on and be resilient about the whole thing.
All right, we're going to go now to Pam calling us from Maui. Aloha, Pam. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. Thank you so much. So my question is regarding this system. We call these institutions nonprofits, and then, of course, we expect to profit from the good work that we're doing. But by calling ourselves this in the meaning of, like, U.S. dollars, it puts us inside of a certain system that, I don't know, almost seems like losing in a way, and I wonder about your thoughts.
Okay, Pam, I'm going to just kind of cut to the chase on this just because we're coming up to the top of the hour in a couple of minutes, but I think you're asking about the idea of how nonprofits regard themselves as not necessarily businesses in the way that other for-profit businesses would have no problem in talking about themselves. Is that what you're trying to get to here?
Actually, it's more a matter of valuing things in U.S. dollars.
Okay, but, I mean, that's our currency. So how could we not necessarily put a value on something or in terms of getting a grant or being able to get money? I don't quite understand what you want to get to.
Right, right. So in terms of grants, you would need to do that. But what I'm suggesting is that there are physical things, such as housing or a fish or anything like that.
So in kind donations or wealth of other means?
I beg your pardon?
You're talking about, you know, in-kind donations, wealth of other means, not necessarily just money.
Yeah, well, or even instituting some form of currency that's like coupons or something.
Bitcoin for nonprofits.
Outside the dollar system, yep.
All right, thanks, Pam. We just have a couple minutes left before we're going to have to say goodbye, and I know we've got another call or two on the line, but I want to make sure that we're able to have a coming together as you are leaving, Kelvin,
right,
and moving into a new role. And tomorrow is your very last day as CEO. Micah, come next week. You will be the CEO. And clearly, you'll continue to work together. And thankfully for your organization, you're going to have a lot of institutional memory carried forward. But what do you see as being the greatest challenge as you both look toward this next chapter of HCF?
I think that one of the things that was very enlightening and instructive for us has been the process that we've gone through for this succession. And a lot of nonprofits in the community right now are in similar situations where they've had a longstanding executive who's been in the position. So I would just say that, you know, in our case, we're lucky enough that the board and myself had a conversation about succession almost from the time I started 19 years ago. And this was not something that happened overnight. We worked really hard to build both financial and the people talent pool that we needed to go through a transition. And we were lucky enough to convince Micah to come on board as the internal candidate. The board conducted a open national search for my replacement, and they chose Micah. And so, you know, I really think that one of the things that I just wanted to be sure we got out there was this sense that succession is a really important part of what a board and staff engaged in, and to make it as successful as they can has to be a very deliberate process.
When you first started to talk about succession, people were almost aghast that you were bringing that up. like what, is he going to leave right now? Or I remember that.
Yeah.
Micah, go ahead.
Well, I think the unique piece of this whole equation has been Kelvin. I mean, anybody who knows him knows that he's got a lot more left in his tank. And so it seems like not right that he be stepping away from the position right now. But to his credit, I think he realizes that it's not about him and it's about an organization. And for that unconditional feeling, I mean, he made a calculated and strategic decision to entree an opportunity.
But for you, as you're looking now at this next chapter, what does that mean? What are you starting off in your mind to do?
Well, I think there's tremendous opportunity that Kelvin did not have during his tenure. He provided us a financial platform, a leadership platform, a skill set that exists within our organization to take ourselves to another level. And I'm looking forward to the opportunity to do that.
Well, Micah Connick, we will be watching, and I know we'll have conversations in the future. Thanks so much, and all the best to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having
and
us.
And to you, Kelvin Takeda, not going anywhere for at least a little while. There will be more conversations, too.
I'll still be a pest out there, Beth Ann.
Oh, good. Glad to know that. Kelvin Takeda, and you for joining us for this Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll be back with you tomorrow for the conversation. Meanwhile, have yourself a good rest of the day. Take good care. Aloha.